This is unbelievable. Let's find pages.
I'll be in the book and out of the book tonight. So some pages we'll find and some pages I'll just bring. Nice to see a full house back, at least closer to a full house. For those who think there's some kind of love in the air tonight, I hope that Talmud, you fall in love with it all over again.
That could go a long way here.
That's right. So, I wanted to start with a couple of things actually outside the page, but we're going to be on 83A3 in the Gemara in just a minute's time, or a few minutes, let's say. So, I like, as you know, to remind us of the greater context of what we're learning about. So, we're going to dive into this Mishnah, and it's going to talk about the one who is seized with bulmos. We introduced that last week, the end of class. Machilin oto afilu devarim tmeim. We feed one who is overcome by this, whatever this bulmos is, even with devarim tmeim, even with ritually unfit, or even you could go so far as to say tmeim, impure morsels to eat. So bulmos, according to the footnotes in the Gemara here, footnote 24, is a life-threatening disease induced by hunger. One of its symptoms is that the patient's vision weakens, and when his vision is restored, it is known that the patient has recovered. Okay, so you lose sight. Keep in mind, we're going to look tonight, a little down the line, at this book that I mentioned last week, Julius Prost's Biblical and Talmudic Medicine, translated by Fred Rosner, and talk about a little bit what we know scientifically in terms of the research done in this fantastic compendium of biblical and Talmudic medical research by these genius scholars and doctor who translate it. I want to back up even further, though, just to again recall, we're talking about eating on Yom Kippur. Right? It seems like that's all we're talking about. And it's incredible that it's that level of humanity within the Gemara itself, within the Talmudic culture. You could find passages you disagree with because they are, quote-unquote, what we might call in scholarly circles, difficult texts, making assumptions about gender differences or putting forward an idea that seems not to sit well with us. There are some difficult texts, philosophically, in terms of our modern sensibilities. But at the core of the project is a deep level of humanity with which we approach this, and sometimes that even causes some questions. So, for instance, looking back through some Hasidic work on our Masechta, just to get a sense of where the Hasidim made their drashot about this Masechta and this chapter of our Masechet Yoma, of our tractate Yom Kippur. And I just thought it would be interesting to read this again as a doorway. Now, Tiferet Shlomo, Shlomo of Radansk, was quite the 19th century Talmudic scholar in addition to being a Hasidic leader. You know, if you look at the now up-to-date understandings of the Hasidic era in the Pale of Settlement area, the Poland, Ukraine, Belarus, etc., you really see that some people who were Talmudists first and legalists, halachists, had very much similar inclinations to some who might have been called less legalist-oriented, less halachist-oriented, less posek-oriented, that's Jewish law decisor, less Jewish legal decisor-oriented Hasidim. So you had certain people who were really, mainstream, what we might call, terms not around yet, Orthodox, Mitnagdish, Lithuanian yeshivish, but not Lithuania. I'm talking about in throughout the lands that Hasidism as a movement blossomed. And some of them are as, again, knowledgeable about the ways of halacha and Jewish law and deciding opinion that way as they are about some of what is becoming a new way to market Lurianic ideas and Kabbalistic ideas and mystical approaches, let alone the centrality of a Rebbe-type figure. Right. It's a little bit more meeting of all those minds than we thought previously. That's to say that we know Hasidim are enmeshed with a systemic approach to Jewish living, just like the majority of what we consider to be Orthodox are today, yet they found other ways to renew a spirit within Judaism by taking on the Lurianic way of even just the basics of the Nusach of Tefillah, the liturgy of Tefillah, and the Kavanot, the intentionalities behind them, Yichudim, bringing things together in the heavens, and making comments on everyday Jewish practices that we would call, quote-unquote, everyday Jewish practices from their perspective, and being willing to ask and propose some questions that sounded a little bit, to some ears, what are considered antinomian questions. You know, how could you go against the natural grain of wood by asking that question? You know, when one says in the Gemara, the person who ate on the 9th of Tishrei, it says it's ascribed to that person as if they ate. As if they fasted the 9th and the 10th, because we have a Torah verse that seems to indicate that we should be considering a fast on the 9th, just like we have on the 10th. Right? But how do you really consider that a fast? And what is the meaning, especially when we know this is going to be the approach of the Radamska Rebbe, of the Tiferet Shlomo. But he's trying to get at a deeper spiritual matter, a deeper spiritual issue that comes from the landscape of Hasidic thought about soul life, spiritual life. Spiritual life that sounds, I think, very, very familiar to our milieu, or at least our milieu of the last couple hundred years. So listen to the way he says it. Kashe, the person who's kol she ochel v'shotev chi'i ma'aleh alav ha'katuv ki'ilu hit'aneh chi'i da'as tizri. The one who eats and the one who drinks. On the 9th it says, if we raise above his head the crown of the verse of the Torah that says, it's as if he fasted on the 9th and the 10th. Says kashe. That's very difficult to understand. V'halo b'chol sefer musar mivu'ar b'diyuk ha'hefech. Every book of enlightenment about one's pursuit of building greater character and religious personality says exactly the opposite. Sheribui akila, that the expansion of eating, the touch of this worldliness, the indulgence in food, metonym, the indulgence in the world of gashmiut, in the concrete world down below, right? All of doing too much of that, gorem lepichitat erech hanefesh. That creates a certain withdrawal in soul life, or lessening of a soul connection. So how could you really have a mitzvah that says that you should have a ribui of eating and drinking, an expansion, ribui from rov. How can you have an expansion of eating and drinking on the 9th when you need to have even less to get to the essence of the nefesh, of the soul? And he uses the word advisedly, because the word nefesh comes in all the different verses about Yom Kippur that we saw, that you're supposed to la'anot ha'nefesh. You're supposed to afflict your soul. He doesn't say neshama. He could have chosen different words by this point in the vocabulary, in the storehouse of vocabulary for the soul and the Jewish people, among the Jewish people, because as Hasidim, they're using the same five words for soul, at least five parts for the soul, that all of the mystics know exist. That's ruach, nefesh, neshama, yechida, and chaya. So there are five vocabulary words going around for the soul at the time that he's writing this commentary. Ve'ech tziva chazal be'erev yom hadin. How did the sages of blessed memory, on the eve of Yom Kippur, leharbot v'achila v'shtiyah, could they possibly ask us to increase the eating? On the one hand, you might think even physically it feels full, but on the other hand, feeling full and having so much, then like the crash is worse. And you can't get the soul life, according to the Radhanskar here. Eila Amruba Zohar. Rather, it's said in the Zohar, our central text of mystical attachment. That Shulchan Dvarnash Kaima Lidakale Lavarnash Miko Chavoi Al Yidei Achila Bikdusha. That the entire kind of possibility that you have to sanctify yourself in a certain sense comes through your ability to make holy and sanctify your approach, your entire engagement with eating. And that's why it says you should learn to have yirah, you should learn to have awe, you should learn to have great, great sense of holding God and the world in awe. And that's why the eating on the ninth is a holy practice of fasting in and of itself. Right? So what does he mean by it? He means that if you can achieve the kind of fast that we're really talking about, that is refraining on the 10th, engaging in eating and drinking in a deep way on the 9th, but knowing that you're doing that in order to create the kind of kedusha, the kind of holiness that you can experience in this world, that you are to try to access with the connection you have. That it's as if you were hitane, it's as if you really did afflict yourself. Recognizing that that work is really difficult, it's real difficult soul work to do, and getting into some of, I think, the goals that we've discussed about why this curriculum even builds up the way it does, and why the mitzvah of the ninth, and why the mitzvot of the tenth, and then the context for the pregnant woman, the sick individual, and now the guy taken over by the vomos, right? We have a deeper context, and I think that it was interesting to me today, not that there was any discussion of this in regard during the Talmudic era, in regard to what today represents on the Christian calendar, but I was thinking about how today is Ash Wednesday, right? And I don't know if you saw people today.
Yeah.
And I was also thinking about yesterday being Shrov Tuesday, but also what?
Fat Tuesday.
And Mardi Gras, right? And so, whereas the day before Ash Wednesday was a sacred, even solemn occasion, when you talk about the root for Shrove Tuesday, I believe, you have Mardi Gras that was made of it. And Mardi Gras, you know, is this, you know, big fat celebration, right, down in New Orleans and in other areas where Mardi Gras is played up. South America, Carnival, depending on when Carnival happens, it's not always associated with this, as I understand the sociology of Carnival. But you could imagine that there's some inkling to kind of make the ninth some, you know, bigger celebration and some kind of more passionate kind of simcha within the notion that the next day we're going to take a break from it all and God is going to ultimately grant pardon and tzlicha, and somehow the culture could have developed, in a ritual sense, a little bit like that. All religions develop in a certain way. God, in a certain sense, gives us this set of commandments. And within that, the comparison sometimes to the way that, you know, other cultures create out of their possibilities the kind of celebrations they do, then comparing back to how we do this, you know, the art of worshiping and bringing Torah to life, and if it was borrowed or if it was kind of left behind to go a different direction, the Jewish way of making the ninth meaningful and powerful is to have this meal. It seems a bit more practical and down to earth that way than it does any kind of let's make a great carnival atmosphere out of this moment of anything God's going to do on Yom Kippur. And to achieve the kind of connection on a soul level that the Radomsker though is asking for, again, that will not be done through the air of carnival or the air of a Mardi Gras kind of approach. It'll be done through the seriousness of getting together to eat, the seriousness of getting together and for the whole community. Remember, like, what's coming up right after that meal on the 9th? Kol Nidre develops. The nature of being there for Kol Nidre and the intensity of Kol Nidre. To say that what we did with our mouths just before by way of words and what we're doing with our mouths now by way of recognizing what we did with our mouths, that is that we eat and we ate and we are going to fast and we're not going to eat and we're going to take this cheshbon, this counting of our souls by way of our relationship to the food, and we're also going to be serious about the words that come out of our mouths as well, and Kol Nidre becomes the deepest, you know, more meaningful moment on the ninth, even than the meal. So we move towards liturgy, we move towards the seriousness of releasing people from vows, saying the words that we use in our lives are serious. An element, by the way, that we haven't gotten to just yet, right? We haven't really concentrated on the words that fly and what one needs to use words for by way of repentance and all that, which will come at the very end of this parak. But it's just a bigger picture again. The whole scenery of this tractate coming into focus. As we think about that, we also have noticed that this experience in Yom Kippur is very connected to the whole notion of Sabbath observance in and of itself, because what is Yom Kippur called in the Torah? Shabbat Shabbaton. And we don't want to lose sight of that either. And when we talk about feeding this person on Yontif, we're talking about the same pikuach nefesh that we're talking about with Shabbat. So if pikuach nefesh is dochet haShabbat in halachic terms, now to move to this other area that I want to just remember as we read our Gemara going forward, we have to remember that you can push aside all the Sabbath observances and laws in order to really make sure that you are treating the sick however they need to be treated, not just treating them kindly, treat them with medicine, with the right kind of food that they need to eat. You have to make these determinations and go ahead and break the Sabbath. I brought down these two books. So these two books sit on a lot of shelves in Shomer Shabbat families. These are two volumes called Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata. I understand that there already was, or there may be a revision in the works. There are two volumes, and if you kind of want to double-check yourself on, you know, whether or not this is permissible or that's permissible on a Sabbath, you go and you grab these books off the shelf. So one time I'm sitting in Ramat Bet, something like that, outside of Jerusalem by a very, very intensely religious family, and it's Shabbat, and I'm there with my friend Michael, and he's got lots of cousins, and there's kids running around. Everybody's, you know, apart. You can imagine the community, and it's black and white. It's just, I call it, you know, black and white experience. And incredible. And there was a question about, you know, salt and whether or not the salt that was piled on the table to dip the bread is now salt that you can grab with your fingers and you can sprinkle it on your food, or you should leave it on the altar. So they're running, pulling books. Everybody's got, you know, wouldn't you know, cover salt.
And what's the answer to that question?
No, you shouldn't use the salt on just for the bread. Salt for the mizbech. But again, like, humanity will come through. Humanity will come through because what we cover in these books are some of what grows out of our Gemaras. So, Mu'uberet Yoledet Meinik, the one who's also nursing. Meinikik. Mu'uberet U'meinikot U'mit'anot U'mashlimot B'yom HaKivurim. The first one says, all of these people, the one who's pregnant, the one who's nursing, should fulfill the fast of Yom Kippur. But someone who has a little bit of a tava, a little bit of an appetite, or gets a little hungry, v'hi mevakeshet le'chol, or shenikar b'faneh shehi tzricha le'chol, or it's known that she really needs to eat. That's the way it's said, just in general like that. It's obvious that she needs to eat. Ma'achilin otah. Mimachal ze b'shivrim ad sheteyashev da'ata kemivuar lahar. So that we should definitely make sure she eats what she needs to eat so that she comes back to us. She comes in. So I just wanted to show you that these are, you know, very live wires in worlds where this is very serious. And trust me, if you are in those communities for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and you go, because that's where I was there. I mean, you can look around at the women. There are many pregnant women in those communities. Okay? There are many pregnant women. And so it's really a big question. It's really a big question. There's a journal article recently about the cholim in Shaarei Tzedek and Hadassah Hospital that we learned. Actually, it was a team learning one night. There were testimonials from patients who said that they were disagreeing with their physicians about their own abilities to fast, or they had disagreements with their physicians and nurses about whether or not they should eat on Yom Kippur, and how that was worked out, with other doctors being called in, with family members being called in. And because these are serious, serious questions for people in their spiritual lives / in their everyday kind of approach to what halakha is to guide us through, and how we're to live our lives and fulfill these words of the Torah. So it's not only, I wanted this to mention this, because this is not in a vacuum. This is very real for people who are very concerned that the question of I'm ill and should I eat is a deeply important question for any given Yom Kippur. Right? So it's important for us to just say that as we go forward. Yeah.
But there was a big thing that you said here. I can understand if it's a matter of life and death. But you're saying with pregnant women, even the urge, which is not life-threatening.
Right. I mean, because we're still very much in awe in terms of halachic codes, I would say, of pregnant women and unborn Jews. We want to make sure if they need food, they get it. I really think that comes out in all these studies.
That same applies to someone that's sick with an urge.
Yes, and you have this journal from Israel. It's a nursing journal, actually, that was reporting on patients who were really uncomfortable with the notion that they were being asked by their doctors and nurses to eat something on Yom Kippur. Right? I mean, obviously, we go by the expert opinion in those cases, so don't let me misrepresent. Their opinions mattered. In the end, if someone really medically was in need of some nourishment and they didn't want it by ingesting it this way, they would set up the right line and do it at the drip stage, less than a date's bulk, you know, not a full cheek's worth. Didn't say that on the bag, but I could see them making decisions, you know, along those lines, because those are the measurements that we still have in use. In the religious community, was measuring out these proportions. I told you about the one person who was really serious about that in our own community, who really took it seriously, who found it to be entirely meaningful on one year, that he was really struggling to work out how he was going to eat, but how he was still going to fast, and he ate only the dates bulk or less of food as the day went forward. I encouraged him to write something for Orot, but he didn't really want to, you know, share so publicly. That's okay, you know. But I asked if I could share publicly enough, in case somebody knows him in the room, to say it was pretty powerful. We learned the sources. We looked at the answers. Really neat. And I'll say one other word about that. Another young woman who was really struggling with an eating disorder came to me once before Yom Kippur, and it's very moving. I said to her, come, you know, tell me a little bit about why you're feeling like you shouldn't fast. She was really in a mode of consciously working out whether or not it would be even one day possible to go through this. And we talk all about this Mishnah that we just wound up with last week, about the chole self-reporting, about the sick individual, about the ill individual self-reporting and reacting to what the doctors had said and what therapists might have suggested. And we worked it out through and how. And again, the whole dates bulk was entirely and so powerfully meaningful to her. And this is a young lady who is not, you know, looking at this length and that length and whether or not I said every word of the davening or what have you. It was just really meaningful for her to be able to celebrate, commemorate, participate in Yom Kippur in our community. So, really just thinking about all that as I was looking at this next Mishnah. This can sometimes feel like with this next one, I guess, you know, when we learned it in school, like all of a sudden it's ravenous and there's no vision, I've lost vision, I need to eat, you know. We feel for the person if we really think about what's happening, and we also see it as the Mishnah is like taking into all these kind of extreme situations, but in extremis makes for cases, and also it's very real in many ways. Yeah.
I just realized I had emergency surgery on the night of Yom Kippur. I had to go in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. And my next door neighbor was a surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
That came over and called it in. So what happened was next morning was Yom Kippur. He comes over, he says, we have to eat. He was going to shul from there. And I felt that was fine. I didn't have to. But he insisted that I eat.
Hey, and you went by the expert.
Yeah.
Good for you. Yeah. You did the right thing. All right. See there? Right among us. We've had the experience. Okay. Let's learn the Mishnah. 83A3, and we'll push forward into this section of the Gemara. Mi she'achazo bulmos. One who sees with bulmos, which we said is this disease, or this episode, life-threatening, vision weakens. Ma'achilino to'afilu devarim t'meim. We feed him even non-kosher foods. Now, it says non-kosher in the art scroll, in the Stein salts over here. It says we feed him even impure foods on Yom Kippur or any other day until his eyes recover. So what's the difference between non-kosher and impure? So A, it could be nothing. B, it could be that tamei meant that it's not ritually prepared and ready food, like food that I've yet to take a tithing out of, which will come up later in the Gemara. So, non-kosher versus non-ritually prepared food could be the difference that the two translators are picking up on. Ad she'yaodu le'enav. We feed him until his vision's restored. Mish and Ishacho Kelev Shote, one who's bitten by a mad dog. So here we have mad dogs in the Gemara. We'll hear more. Ein Machilino to Mechatzar Kaved Shelo. We don't feed him from its liver at all. They thought that by feeding someone from the liver lobe, of a mad dog that they would have the antidote. Now, if you look, Rashi says about this dog, Kelev Shote. He says, Mifaresh b'Gemara. That will be explained later in the Gemara. Rashi often will say, I'm not going to tell you all about what it's really talking about here because you're going to read it later in the Gemara, and that's part of what Rashi kind of says to you, Viter, go. You don't need to know this right now, but later on you'll hear in the Gemara. But Ein Marchilin Machater Kaved Shelo, you don't feed him from a liver lobe. Afal pi sheno hagin harofim berifuazu, even though it's common by doctors to actually use the liver lobe to do this kind of healing. Ein harifuah gemura, it's not a complete kind of treatment that creates recovery. Lahatir lo isur behemat meah al kach, and since it's not a full out antidote to the problem, then we do not permit doctors to take this treif meat, this unkosher meat, and feed it to the patient. Steinsaltz will say the following about severity of forbidden foods. So the prohibitions relating to food are hierarchical. Eating untithed produce is more severe than eating non-kosher meat. Eating untithed produce is even more severe than eating non-kosher meat. It is worse to eat non-kosher meat than aftergrowths from the sabbatical year, which are forbidden by rabbinic law. Remember, there's a distinction between Torah law and rabbinic law. It is worse to eat untithed produce than produce grown in the sabbatical year, which is forbidden by Torah law. If there is a choice between eating untithed produce and truma, one should separate the tithes from the untithed produce even on Shabbat or festivals. So if I have untithed produce that needs to be tithed, and it's the Sabbath, I'm going to see this later in the Gemara, but Steinsaltz wants to summarize it for us now. It's good to summarize, and then they'll read it inside. I can do that work on a Sabbath, which one would think you could not, because you're transgressing one of the primary malachot, the primary categories of labor that you can't transgress, and that is separating out this from that. So you wouldn't separate, but it says, no, that's what you must do. One should separate the tithes from the untithed produce, even on Shabbat or festival. If that's not possible, one should eat the untithed produce, as that is less severe than eating truma. So truma, I'm sorry if we didn't say, truma is this set aside portion. For whom? What? It's for the Kohanim, right. So Truma itself is already set aside. And then I have produce that's over here. And you might have thought, since this was already separated, I should eat from that. But you should separate this group over here and do the work, even though it's a Shabbat, then eat the Truma over there. So the point is that with that small system of hierarchy, we see that you've also got to make some pretty serious decisions, right? So what do they call this when you're tripping over your own feet, maybe? Right? Someone's ravenous, they've got the bull moose, they've lost their sight, right? And then you come out and you have to say, hold on. And you pull the card out. Which one's more severe? Which one's more severe? Right? That's what it's going to sound like. That's what it's going to sound like. So think about why that would be an approach at all in this moment of being so humane as to feed somebody on Yom Kippur. Why do we still have that requirement? Why is that the discussion? Quick, this guy's going to die. Someone get him some food. Wait, is that truma? Have you tithed that pile of produce? And wait, is it that we have the non-kosher meat because the guy next door had left that here, and you remember somebody smelled it over there, so the guy who smelled it over there, maybe it was the pregnant woman who got a little taste of it. We had brought some. What I'm saying is that it seems to be built up in a kind of systemic way here, and the Gemara is going to get into that systemic way, and someone could very well ask the question, come on, why shouldn't we just feed him the closest thing that we can get our left hand on? I want us to think about why it's presented in this way. What meaning does it have that the rabbis go through this kind of approach to say, yes, we feed someone who's been overcome and just lost their vision? What is it there to teach us? What's it there to encourage us to do? How to be? Okay, keep that in mind as we just go through the rest of this Mishnah. Rabbi Matia ben Harash Matir. Rabbi Matia ben Harash permits feeding him from that liver lobe. V'odama Rabbi Matia ben Harash. And since we mentioned Rabbi Matia ben Harash, he's going to say Hachoshesh Bigrono, one who feels pain in his throat. Matilin lo sam betoch piv b'Shabbat. We even put a medicine in his mouth for him on Shabbat, right? Which is, that's a certain kind of medicine that was used to cure a disease. It says down below of what's called tefidna. He maintains that the medicine's effective, hence its production is permitted on the Shabbat, in addition to actually giving it to him. So the production of medication in the ancient world is, imagine like the old pharmacy, where the guy is using the mortar and pestle. And you've got the whole kind of, whether it's herbs or stones with powders and different kinds of, or you're mashing certain kinds of foods that you think have medicinal properties, or you're squeezing nectar, or you're getting sap. All these kinds of things would normally be a malacha on Shabbat. But he's saying, no, you do this. You do this for him. And he's got this, the pain in the throat issue going. He says, why? Mipnei shehu spek nefashot. Because it's possible danger to life. Spek nefashot. V'chol spek nefashot doche et ha-shabbat. And even though I'm in the Yom Kippur tractate, I say it directly because it's a principle in the law that falls very nicely on the ears of people who know the rabbinic system of law, who depend on Shabbat law week to week, who know Shabbat law week to week, who take Shabbat really seriously week to week, and who are connecting with the notion of Yom Kippur as Shabbat Shabbaton, that chol sfek nefashot doches ha-shabbat. How do we say that otherwise within the Jewish corpus, within the legal corpus? Pikuach nefesh doches ha-shabbat. Saving a life supersedes all of the Sabbath regulations. Here, we say it a little differently, just to note what, you know, differences of expression. We don't say saving a life. We say chol safek nefashot. Any little bit of a
doubt
that, or any little bit of a, how else might I be able to then translate safek? Any little, like, risk or any kind of worry at all, and it's not the word worry, but any kind of potential danger to life, doche et ha-shabbat, supersedes Shabbat regulations. So it's saying it in a strong way, coupling that with the other pikuach nefesh, right? Because pikuach nefesh, saving a life, might be a little different than fake nefeshot. Mishnah goes further. Mish and nafla alav mapolet, and talking about all kinds of things we can do on Shabbat. The one upon whom a building collapsed. Now remember, we're talking about what kind of buildings in the ancient world? We're talking about stones. We're talking about the mud that's between stones if it's not pitch and it's not exactly the mortar of today. We're talking about sticks and mud that make up roofs. We're talking about sticks, mud, branches. We're talking about some kind of earthen clay that's up there, and perhaps even there's someone above who's on the next story of that little build-up of what I guess you consider them to be, like, the closest thing in my mind which doesn't look so Southwestern, but, you know, the Pueblo dwellings in a certain way. A little bit Talmudic villages have some resemblance, Lahatil, to these kind of Pueblo build-up structures in some way. And so you might have some of that. Or you just might simply have that roof is just collapsed on them, or the stones themselves. Who knows about the earth moving a little bit at that time, if they had certain seismic activity as well. So you have these collapses. Safek hu sham, safek enu sham. And it's uncertain whether or not the person is there. Safek chai, safek me. And it's unclear whether he's alive or dead. Safek kuti, safek Yisrael. Whether he's a Kutite or a Jew. And over here, in the Steinsaltz. Right, it has, do you have the sign itself? Yeah, so it has the word goy and not kuti. So we ask, you know, we ask which manuscript is the original. Sometimes the question which is original isn't the really operative question. He says, which are the various words we see in various manuscripts that come to create the spectrum analysis between Jew and non-Jew? Over here in the art scroll, it has the word kuti. And over there, by Steinsaltz, he's got the word goy. And so, goy is the word for of other nations. Kuti, 32, is really a code word for what sometimes appears in other manuscripts, and that is Oved Zara, or Oved Kochavim, an idol worshiper. We're talking about someone who definitely is an idol worshiper. Now, goy probably means the same thing, that it's someone who is not of the Jewish faith and worships idols.
But you can eat the shechita of a kuti.
Well, that's up for debate too.
It's written in this book.
That's up for debate. So, the notion here, though, is that the Mishnah does present a question which, as advertised by way of the Gemara's tractate this year, so now brings the question, how does this Masechta help us with thinking of ourselves as Jew and other, as Jews among nations of the world, as Jews with unique Sabbath and Yom Kippur laws who have to interact with the rest of the world? Was that person there because they were, you know, quote-unquote, Shabbat Goy? Or was that person there because, again, this is talking about a little bit more of one of those cosmopolitan areas where next door the person is not Jewish and they were cooking that meat from the last Mishnah? These are questions, and there's going to be a little bit more text that relates to our relationships with non-Jews, and throughout the centuries ahead, you'll see texts come up that deal with the questions, exactly the question of this Mishnah: what if something collapses, am I able to do search and rescue for an area where there are Jews and non-Jews, or just where there are Jews, or just where there are non-Jews? And some of those answers are more universal, and some of those answers are more particular. Right? But this really begins, not just begins, but that is part of that whole question of our relationship. And it says, Mefakhin alav et hagal, they must clear away the heap of rubble to rescue him. Matzahu chai mefakhin. If they find him alive, they clear away the rubble. Ve'im meit, but if they find that he's dead, Yanichuhu, they leave him there, so that they come back and do the proper work with the rubble and the sticks and the stones and the sticks and the stones. And the point here is how serious this is, that philosophically, for pikuach nefesh, you have all the laws superseded. For sfeik nefeshot, for any inkling that one could save a life, the law is set aside. The regulations are set aside. But once you have a mate, once you determine that the person is dead, there is no, at least so far in the Mishnah, there is no room to set the law aside. And that's considered, obviously, for the Mishnah, a respectful enough way to deal with the collapse and to deal with the decision you have to make on the spot about what just happened under that rubble. That's going to start us on the Gemara. Now, question just before that, who's the he? Whether he is alive or dead, spek chai spek meit. Right? So whether he's alive or whether he's dead, does it say, by the way, which one, whether it's the Yehudi or the Kuti, or the Yehudi or the Goy?
No.
It doesn't seem to say that. It doesn't seem to say that. Let's just look to be sure. It doesn't say it in the Rashi. Let's check to be sure the Tosfot don't call it, no, it doesn't say it in the Tosfot. In other words, I want someone to clarify for me who's being discussed. Or maybe I don't, because whether he's a dead or alive could apply just as well to either. What I'm suggesting is that the inclination might be that someone comes along and says, that means the he means only if it's the Jew. That might not be the way that might not be the way that you read it.
No, I see.
But
I'm saying if this one particular person who was there, that's who you...
Right, exactly. Yeah, or you don't know either of them,
yeah,
and therefore you can, that's only when you know one of them, right? You know, all kinds of things can happen if you're not more specific about requiring for all, in all cases.
Back to the truma. If there is no untied food, if there is only truma in the neighborhood, can I use the truma?
Yeah, because the Gemara is going to want to know this. Okay? The Gemara now is going to deal with the whole set of situations in the Mishnah. Let's jump in. 83A4. Ron wants to know, can I feed in the truma if I have nothing else? See if the passages answer your question, Ron.
Because it's not clear who it is. So even if it's a non-Jew but he's alive, they should clear the rubble.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's how we're going to read it.
What if he's a she?
We're going to read it that is a merism, right? That from Kuti to Jew, or from Goy to Jew, from man to woman, all included in there. You know, we're saying those are the far ends of the spectrum. Gemara, 83A4. Now we're back to Bulmus. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught in a brighta, Minayin hayu yodin shehei iruenov. How do they know that his vision has been restored? I mean, you're telling me to feed him to the point where his vision is restored. How do I even know that his vision is restored? Right? What do I mean by vision? Look at the Rashi. Rashi says, "Machilin oto." Sheyodei lahavchin bein ta'am. It's the first wide line. Bein ta'am tavshil yafei leta'am tavshil ra. He knows how to make a distinction between something that tastes decent and good and something that is just lousy.
What does that have to do with vision?
What does that have to do with vision?
Yeah, but it's Yom Kippur. It's during the day, so I don't understand why they're talking about the dark.
It's not really talking about the dark. In other words, what he's saying is that he's going to eat until the person is really kind of... The Meiri talks about the nighttime, when one can't test whether the ill person is able to distinguish food by sight. In that case, one checks whether he can discern different tastes. And the different tastes are kind of like, does he have a sense of insight about what he's eating and, you know, kind of, what does it mean by way of his recovery, that he gets to a place where he's able to distinguish, his mind is at ease. And he's able to distinguish, you know, between this taste and that taste, and they ask him that, and in that sense you say, quote-unquote, his vision is restored.
It also means that he's had enough. He's not so ravenous that he'll eat anything.
Right, right. And and that right now it's a little too much. Right? And that he's expressing that. And that if it's about taste and he doesn't want it because that's not satisfying, yes. And if it's too much and he doesn't need it, he'll be able to say so. Perhaps.
So then you're testing him by feeding him something bad?
Maybe. That's my next question. Like, it says, even mishavechin bein tov l'ra. Like, are you supposed to have the tov stuff on one plate and the ra stuff on the other? Good stuff over here, the nasty stuff over here. You keep the nasty stuff around in case someone gets the bulmus, obviously. And then you say, here you go. And he eats both while he's got the bulmus. And then all of a sudden when the bulmus passes, he says, oh, why are you giving me that? It's terrible. It's a very funny scenario here. Abaye tries to explain. Amar Abaye.
This is that he's able to see that it's rotten?
Uvatama. That's to say he can differentiate between them through taste. In other words, wait a minute. He says that his taste comes back. You do have to try to give him something that he doesn't really like, know his food. He with a bulimus, he's just going to try to eat anything you put in his mouth. So now I'm thinking, it means kind of like the difference between put, and here's kind of, I'm now maybe not retrojecting, but I'm taking the little bit of experience with helping someone who's having a seizure. Right? What are we supposed to do with someone who has a seizure? So they won't swallow their tongue?
Press the tongue.
They're supposed to either hold it or bite down on something, right? There's all kinds of different protocols for when someone's gripped by this. I remember there were a few children in day school, in the day school where I was heading, where the nurse had certain response protocols for kids. You know, everybody who has allergies has an EpiPen, and you go and you learn, you get trained how to put the EpiPen in the thigh. For a certain child, they need to have something that they supposedly bite down on because it holds the jaw in a certain way. Maybe what they're saying is that until the time that he can actually get a little food in him, and he eats something as opposed to him just having maybe something in his mouth, is that the scenario? I'm not really 100% positive. I'm not 100% positive, but it sounds like there's some kind of distinction between him having his senses and him not having his senses. And if he's just eating to eat, and then he ultimately can say, oh, that's good. Maybe he's saying that's good, like I've had enough. But he's saying that's good, meaning I can actually taste it, and we feel like his senses are back, and then we're okay.
Maybe it just means feeding him something he doesn't typically like, as opposed to who he likes.
My problem with that, again, is like, how do I know that? How do I know?
Stranger across town you've never seen before.
Well, I think that's that's kind of like the diuk. You could make that diuk. You could say, no, let me explain when we're talking about, which case we're really talking about. When we're at the house and we know the person who's going through this and we give him foods that he doesn't like plus foods that he does like and he can say, yay, great, I like the kugel.
I'm just having a problem with the concept of nobody has rotten food in their home that they're then going to...
I don't know that it's really necessarily rotten. I guess I looked at it as, and whether you know what somebody likes or doesn't like, you have somebody who's very seriously impaired with whom you're feeding them.
Yeah.
And when all of a sudden their behavior is such that it seems clear they're no longer impaired, you know, they have a opinions about things.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden, you know, this is good, this is bad. You know.
Good.
That's
good. So let's I like that. Let's leave it at that, right? Somebody has an opinion about something, and they've come out of their whole craziness about this or their illness and their symptoms. I think that's the simplest explanation. It's good. That's Occam's razor at work. In other words, I can make up all kinds of scenarios, and we could say it's this case, and I've got a piece of wood over here or a belt to chew on and something leather versus actual food that gets him back to health, and finally he says, okay. No. It simply means you're feeding him. Right? And then finally it's like, oh, good, good.
Yeah, I think it's just one addition. I think because it's Yom Kippur, so it's all about Hanai, it's all about enjoying. As long as it's not enjoying the food, it can keep fitting. If it's enjoying the food, then that's where it should stop.
Good.
That's the
good.
I don't know, that's the way I read it.
Oh, this stuff is terrible. You want to eat.
The context is Yom Kippur. The context is avoiding one or moderating one.
Yeah. Nice. Nice. Adds yet the other dimension we need to really just say it simply. But I do think that it can be read in a kind of very technical way that could bring some confusion. All right, let's keep going. Next piece. Gemara goes further. It has another braita about bulmos. Tanu Rabbanan. Mi she'achazo bulmos, the one who is seized with bulmos, ma'achilinoto hakal hakal. We feed him with the least severe of the forbidden foods available. So now, again, now I'm back to my, I've got categories of forbidden foods. And I need to know the system under which I function, with which I function, and I feed the person the least severe of the forbidden foods. Tevel unvela. Now let's do some work with are forbidden foods. If I have only tevil, which is punishable by death at the hands of heaven, b'yidei shemayim, if I eat tevil, tevil is the produce from which truma and masrot have to be separated. Meaning, tevil is produce, and I have to separate out my offering for the kohen, and in certain years, my offering for the levi. And I have that, and I have nevela. And a nevela, it's a kosher animal, but it's an animal that does not get shechted in the right way. Ma'achilinot on nevela. We feed him nevela, and not the tevel. Tevel ushvi'it. What happens if I have the tevel? I haven't separated my maaser, I haven't separated my truma. And I have shvi'it, meaning Shemitah produce, that I'm not allowed to eat, because I had to leave my land fallow and I couldn't eat it. Shvi'it, we feed him the Shemitah produce. Shemitah produce being de'oraita, by the Torah law, I still feed him that, versus the tevel, that I had to separate out my truma and maaser. Discusses another case. Tevel utruma. This fruit from which, the produce from which I had to separate out, Kohanic, Levite tithes, and truma, that which is set aside for the Kohen. Tana Ehi. There's a Tanaitic dispute. A Tanaitic dispute. Titania, as I saw in a brighter, Machilino to Tevel, we feed him Tevel the ain Machilino to Truma. In this case, I feed him the Tevel out of which I have yet to actually tithe my Kohenic and Levite portions. But I don't feed him the Truma because the Truma has already been separated and it's there for Kohenic. Ben Tame Omer, but I told you it was a debate among the Tanaim. Ben Tame Omer, Truma velo Tevel. Ah, opposite. He's going to feed him truma and not the tevel. Now, to Ron's question, have I a situation where I only have one? I didn't get that yet, so your question's really not answered yet. But from what you've learned right now, could you answer your own question?
Yeah.
Which is?
Right now, machilim notos the truma by the second guy is truma.
Exactly. You would go with Ben Tema, who, and you would rely on Ben Tamer's opinion.
Because what I think they are doing is because the table you need to do some work on Shabbat to separate it, and they are trying to make less work as possible as much as they want to save the guy. Because to separate the work in the table to Truma and Maaser, it takes time and it's work, and you're not supposed to do work on Shabbat.
Nice. So you think that the whole system
is to avoid work and give him as quick as possible food that is ready.
Okay. So in other words, if I have Tevel and Nevela, feed him Nevela. No separating from the Tevel. Tevel and Shemitah, I feed him Shemitah. Again, no separating on Shabbat. Tevel and Truma, Tanaitic dispute. Taught in Avraita, we feed him Tevel. So that there's over there,
that's even.
No work. And Truma,
if you don't do
no
the
work.
Work. You don't
so,
do work.
So far I have no work on Shabbat in terms of separating.
If that's the principle, it should have said that that's the principle.
Ah, so why didn't I just say, feed him that which is closest to you, right? And don't worry.
The easiest.
And don't worry about the whole kind of deraita of Shemitah versus, like, I had a question. It was deraita of Shemitah. I might have thought that the rabbinic system of all these other separations, I should have superseded it. They didn't say that, though, but you could probably infer it. They're looking to help us avoid the kind of work that might disqualify us from keeping Shabbat. The Gemara now, though, goes a little further, qualifies this dispute. Amar Rabbah. Rabbah says the following. Where it's possible to feed him with the chulin that remains after the mandatory portions have been separated from the tevel. So I have this chulin. You see here that there's so much tevel after separating truma, enough produce will remain to satisfy the patient's needs. The chule alma lo plige, the mitakninan le umasfinan le. All agree that we render the tevel fit for consumption by separating these portions, and we feed him the rest of the chulin, that which is there to be eaten. Ki flige, where do they disagree? The lo efshar bechulin, where it's not possible to feed him with the remaining chulin. In other words, that amount that we don't have, that we have there, is not enough to actually feed the person who needs to eat. Maris of our tevel hamur, one master, Ben Tema, thought that tevel, Ben Tema holds tevel is more severe than truma. In other words, that's the bigger transgression. Hence, he should be fed the truma. Umar Savar truma chamura, and the other master thought that truma is more severe than tevel. Hence, he should be fed tevel. Umar explains the two sides of the dispute. Umar Savar tevel chamur. One master Ben Tema holds that tevel is more severe because it's prohibited to all. About truma chazay lechoen, whereas truma is a fit for a kohen. And Mar Savar, this other guy, thought Savar Truma Chamura, and the other master, the Tanakama, holds that Truma is more severe because it cannot be rendered fit for consumption of Al Tevel Efshar Litkanue, whereas Tevel can be rendered fit for consumption by separating the mandatory portion. So ultimately, what am I left with at the end? A little bit of philosophy about sanctification of food for whom? The priests. And I want to relate that a little bit, and it's not just the work on Shabbat that I want to relate to, but I want to also learn from that I'm interested in the priests, and remember that Yom Kippur is a day that I'm reading again some of the great work of the priests within the Beit HaMikdash, and maybe that we need to relate to questions of both the Shabbat and Shabbat laws and what we do or don't do on Shabbat, in addition to that which we hold holy in our midst, and that is we hold the Kohen holy, and therefore food that we would have set aside for the Kohen, we would say potentially that that's the holier food and therefore given from the table and not the Truma.
So the argument, as I gather, is one argument is we know that the Truma is reserved for the priest. So don't give him that. Give him the Tevel.
Right.
The other side of the argument is no one's supposed to eat Tevel, neither the Kohanim nor everybody else.
That's true. Table's prohibited to a Kohen.
Table's prohibited to everybody, but at least we know what the Truma is, and so the priests, they should declassify it. And and because it's okay for somebody to eat.
Right.
The kahana.
Right.
And it would be okay to take it away in this instance from the kahanim and give it to somebody else who needs it. That's the argument that says that's less troublesome than going into a food source which no one can ever eat.
That's right. That's right. So another dimension. Another dimension.
It's an interesting logic. I don't know.
Right. Which of this food
yeah.
is permitted,
mm-hmm.
and which is yet to be, if it can be permitted. Nice. Another dimension there, and that is a dimension of kashrut, the same way that something is either an animal that's been shechted right in is kasher, or it's a nevela. That is a kasher animal, but not really fit for us.
So I have a tricky question. If there is only truma food, the Kohen in the Bet Midrash or in the Shul would say, no, that's
the Beit
HaMikdash, don't give it to the sick.
That's a tricky question.
That's what they're saying.
One side of the argument is, no, they should.
No, we already agreed that you're not allowed to do labor on Shabbat or Yom Kippur. That's the reason the Tevel is forbidden. So now you only have truma.
You're adding one element that's not here in the Gemara.
No, but then it's only truma.
I understand you want to get the question there.
Right.
You're adding the element that we have one
separation
and only the one, and whether or not we would give that up to the sick person.
In my opinion, I'll give him the tevel. That's not my opinion.
I'm saying that in the Gemara, the question is between this pile and that pile, which one do we give him? So I would say that the answer would be to your question, since we're always finding the right one to give to the sick, if you only had one, right? You, of course, would give to the sick.
No, but you raised that the food is for the Kohanim, and you need to
you raised
the
that.
Kohen, so I want to see the Kohen that said, no, it's my food, don't give it to the sick.
What I'm suggesting to you is that when we raise that, instead of taking it to the level of, oh, you're going to go to the extreme and say, the Kohen will never give that up, nor would the rabbis have anyone else eat that food, that's not the real reason why it's here. The real reason why it's here is because on a spiritual, philosophical approach to what the Day of Yom Kippur is about, feeding someone who's ill is all about, is to consider whether the food was permitted, is to consider a hierarchy and a kind of agreement that you have to participate in this set of laws that creates some food is more forbidden than others. Consider how, whether it's just historically or not, because this is being written with historical reality in mind, consider historically that you went so far as to consider the Kohenic food as having a degree of sanctity.